Thank you very much. And I hand over to Russ for the next topic.
Okay. The next topic is going to be discussing fair value. Project manager who's been leading the board's efforts, and she'll give you a description about what we did and why and when we expect to issue this. So, Erica, I'll turn it over to you.
Good afternoon. Today I'm going to give you a brief overview on the fair value measurement disclosure project that the board recently completed their redeliberations on, and this was mentioned in the previous session. The slides that I'll refer to are included in FASB Memorandum 6A. To provide a little bit of background, as Kelly mentioned, this project was a topical review that was part of the disclosure framework project, and the board issued an exposure draft in December 2015 and is now working towards a final. The final is in production to be released in the third quarter. As part of this project, the FASB decided to, you know, they tested the concepts, and they also wanted to improve the effectiveness of the notes in the financial statements. Throughout the project, the board sought feedback from various stakeholders, including preparers, users, regulators, and practitioners, among a variety of industries. The board also leveraged the extensive feedback they received on all the past fair value projects as well as to the recent outreach that we had on these specific amendments. The board first identified a broad range of possible information for consideration based on the concepts that were in the disclosure framework. And they identified additions, removals, and modifications based on those concepts. And from that broad set, the board then identified a narrower set of disclosures based on various factors such as the cost-benefit analysis that's been mentioned in the previous topic. The board, because of this, the board didn't use the concepts rigidly. That is, if a disclosure was indicated, the board then went on and analyzed the cost-benefit analysis to determine if that should be a disclosure that is required. So it was really a general guide. For example, the board considered requiring a roll forward of both level one and level two of the fair value hierarchy, as well as the pre-existing level three requirement. The board also considered expanding disclosure of level three unrealized gains and losses to level one and level two, because this was information that users told us was useful and was indicated by the framework. Differences in industry needs of those users made this a very difficult decision for the board to perform the cost-benefit analysis, but the board ultimately decided that they wouldn't add these requirements based on the cost-benefit, that the cost would not justify the benefits, and although these were indicated by the concepts. I'm not going to go into detail on the specific amendments. The amendments were, you know, not too significant. There's not too many changes, not a lot of additions. Because I think that demonstrated that the disclosures were already effective after this review. So just to give you a little overview of the amendments, on slide five are the disclosures that the board removed. The board determined for, you know, one, the amount of reasons between level one and two that this was not cost-beneficial disclosure, as well as the qualitative policy of timing between transfers was not useful disclosure. And then the valuation processes for level three fair value measurements dealt with internal, for example, a description of internal control policies. This was not, the board felt that based on the framework was not appropriate for inclusion in the notes, although it would be useful. And the final bullet here is that the board removed at a minimum. The topic 820 said a few times that an entity shall disclose at a minimum, and stakeholders thought that this was very difficult to apply materiality to these requirements because it was very restrictive. So the board during this project was able to hopefully push stakeholders a little towards using materiality because we removed at a minimum. So it really just says, you know, an entity shall disclose, but it doesn't have that at a minimum in there. On slide six are a few modifications that were done to align with the concepts, mainly to avoid an entity having to disclose future-orientated information because the future-oriented information required by these two qualitative disclosures were not inputs to measure, so they wouldn't be appropriate for the notes. So this project modified these two qualitative disclosures. And on slide 7, the board added two quantitative disclosures that are really extensions of current disclosures, namely the gains and losses, extending that to other comprehensive income in level 3, and second, the range and weighted average, which entities are already required to provide quantitative information, but the board made a specific requirement for the range and weighted average. Additionally, as you see on slide 8, the board extended a few of disclosure exemptions to private companies. As far as transition, the final ASU is expected, as we said, in the third quarter. The standard is effective for fiscal years and interim periods within those fiscal years, beginning after December 15, 2019. And entities may early adopt the standard as soon as it's issued. And now I'll turn it over to Ashley for discussion of the ISV's fair value post-implementation review. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Erica. So I'll now talk you through Agenda Paper 6B. This set of slides provides you a background on IFRS 13 fair value measurement and the International Accounting Standards Board's PIR process. This deck also gives you a general overview of the board's PIR of IFRS 13 and along provides you some feedback that we received throughout the process and highlights the board's next steps and follow-up activities. A large part of the PIR of IFRS 13 focused on the usefulness of disclosures for fair value measurements, which overlap a lot with the FASB's work that Erica just mentioned. So I would like to spend more time discussing this, but before I do that, I would like to pause here to see if the board members have any comments or questions on the other areas of the PIR of IFRS 13, and those are listed on slide 11. So that includes the unit of account and fair value of quoted investments, also known as our P times Q issue, the application of judgments, specifically assessing whether a market is active or whether an input is significant and unobservable, and the application of highest and best use of non-financial assets, and then finally challenges in measuring fair value of biological assets and unquoted equities.
Mark?
So one thing that's not on here that we had gotten a little bit of is fair value of liabilities. Maybe I missed it. Did your PIR generate any discussion about difficulties in fair valuing the right side of the balance sheet?
No, it didn't come up very much. We did our PIR in two stages and focused on four or five topics that came up as the main topics in the first when we went out with our request for information. So it didn't come up to any great extent, really. On your side, was it mainly the own credit that came up, or were there other aspects of liabilities?
No, there were other aspects, too. Obviously, the own credit is something that we hope we've taken a bit of care about, but just the whole issue of how do you think about the fair value of a liability and if it's you know, do you think about it as somebody else's asset versus do you think about it as what 157 might say, which is the exit value, the exit notion, and how do you deal with the marketability aspect of that liability? Do you take that into account? Do you not take that into account? But so really the nuts and bolts of how you think about measurement of a liability, not just the own credit piece, which was certainly there too.
And could I maybe just add that we actually did hear this feedback, I think that you're mentioning, a bit in our first phase, and that was listed in our matrix in our paper that we presented to the board. But the staff did, I think, analyze this out, because then when we were in our outreach, we would ask for the top four, top number one thing that they wanted us to look into. And I think it was disclosures as well. Fair value of liabilities kind of fell out of the...
That's good, because it's not easy.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, great. So now the main area of the PIR of IFRS 13, the usefulness of disclosures. The overall comment we received was that disclosures are generally useful and are greatly improving the transparency of fair value measurements. However, we did hear some concerns around the usefulness of disclosures, in particular relating to level 3 measurements. some issues we heard is that there is some insufficient disaggregation that can make level three disclosures much less useful. We also heard that some disclosures, like the quantitative sensitivity analysis for financial instruments, are poorly understood in practice. So, for example, some stakeholders told us that they view this disclosure as a stress test for the effect of possible future changes, as opposed to measurement uncertainty that existed at the measurement date. We also received several suggestions, you know, for changes to the disclosure requirements to improve the usefulness. These suggestions are also listed on slide 13. The most notable ones were to provide more information about level one and level two measurements, specifically on unrealized gains and losses recognized in profit or loss, and then to better explain the sensitivity analysis for level three measurements. After receiving feedback on the focus areas of the PIR, the board determined that IFRS 13 is working well and has improved financial reporting. In the areas of disclosures, the board has decided to feed the finding into its work on the better communication in financial reporting initiative. Specifically, the board will consider whether to select IFRS 13 for a targeted standards level review, which you heard about a bit earlier in its disclosure initiative. In addition, the primary financial statements project is considering improving disaggregation for financial statements. And the board has decided that there is no need for any other follow-up work in the other areas of the PIR and to continue to liaison with the valuation profession. These decisions have concluded the work on the PIR of IFRS 13, and the board plans to publish a project summary and feedback statement in the second half of 2018. And this document will really help summarize the project's findings as well as the follow-up activities. So I would now like to ask the question on Agenda Paper 6 on page 2, if there are any questions about the FASB's Fair Value Measurement Disclosure Project described in Memorandum 6A, or the ISB's PIR described in the paper I just teed up for you.
Sue?
Yes, thanks both for your presentations. I'd be interested to get a little bit more colour on the proposal that you had to provide further disclosures about fair value gains and losses on Level 1 and Level 2, and what in particular the concerns were that were raised. Given that we had some feedback saying that more information on this would be helpful, and also because now that we've removed available for sale accounting for equities, like you have, I think that there's some more demand potentially for some more visibility about the unrealised gains and losses in P&L on equity investments, and some sort of wondering how much we can pick your brains to think about what the feedback we might get if we were to investigate that might be.
Go ahead, Erica.
So I think the feedback we had gotten from users was that this was useful to a lot of them, that the change in unrealized gains and losses really showed, you know, what management marked up and what could change in future periods. I think what we heard from preparers, though, is that it was very costly. Mainly what we heard is that they don't track the levels of the hierarchy in their systems generally because it's a judgment call. Sometimes there can be a fine line between the levels. And although maybe the system has an automatically generated level, it's a manual process to go through that and determine if that's the correct level for that measurement period. I think also entities told us that they don't track the change in unrealized gain or loss in their system. They don't use this as an internal measure. They track really overall gains and losses, and they don't track the gains and losses by level. That's, the levels aren't something that they track in their system. So I think we heard is that the systems are not set up to provide this disclosure today. They provide it for level three, mainly because, you know, they have their hands on level three constantly because they're valuing these manually. So they can provide this unrealized for level three, but I think for level one and two, which has so much more volume than level three, it's a very costly process, and systems would really have to be, you know, they'd have to go through their systems, they'd have to, you know, make systems to provide this information, and this wouldn't be information they would use internally. So I think there was a lot of discussion in the board about, you know, should this be required for financial services potentially? And I think ultimately the board, you know, though it wasn't a unanimous vote, said that the cost benefit wasn't there because it was so costly.
Okay. And can I just check? So the scope that would have applied to, would that have been to all financial instruments or all things measured at fair value?
All things measured at fair value.
Okay.
Recurring fair value measurements.
So we had multiple meetings. We'd be happy to share the papers. Hal will be happy to share his wonderfully written dissent. But that's the issue we were talking about earlier, that's what this is.
That's a different dissent, but yes.
Large entities.
Also brilliant.
While there are many.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Go ahead, Jim.
Large entities said they would struggle, as Erica said, with the system, just tracking through derivatives, night leaping a collateral. Does that turn an unrealized gain or loss into a realized? Just the operational questions, they said, which they can deal with, have to deal with for level three. It was just if you take that to tens of millions of transactions per year, the system's requirements, they at least asserted, were pretty significant.
Because this is a balance sheet. At the end of the day, this is sort of a balance sheet exercise right now, right? At the end of the period, they figure out what level it's in. It's not like they track it throughout the period going forward to figure out the changes through it. And depending on their policy for when they actually look to see if something's transferred in or out of levels, if they do that monthly versus if they do that at the end of the period, you're going to get a different answer. And we don't require one or another. We just... The cost benefit wasn't there holistically. Am I getting it wrong, Christine?
No, I just wanted to say, though, that users didn't say that they necessarily wanted to see those unrealized gains and losses by level. For them, it wasn't really a level issue. It was a quality of earnings issue, and that realized gains and losses are fundamentally different than unrealized gains and losses. And so they just wanted to see the component of the total amount that was unrealized at the end of the period. So I think the whole argument about doing it by leveling is actually a bit of a red herring, because I think that what they were really saying was it's just the total amount that we wanted to see. We don't care if it's a level one unrealized or a level three unrealized, as much as just knowing what the distinction is between those two components.
Why for an investor would realized be so different from...
Because unrealized can disappear tomorrow. The market just dropped, I don't know how much today.
Realized, depending on what you do.
Never lost money selling a security.
So the finance...
If I lock that gain in, the gain is there.
Right.
But unrealized ebbs and flows.
The institutions came back and said, if you want to know what's at risk, look at the balance sheet, not the income statement.
Okay. Ann?
Thanks, Russ. My question for Erica or anybody else. So my question is about the process that you did in terms of disclosure review. So back on slide 3 of the slide deck, and relevant to what we're looking at doing, you talked about using the concepts that you made and using those concepts to decide about disclosures, and that's very much what we're proposing. My question is, to what extent did you also go back and look at specific standards? Because you talk about using the concepts and using them to guide disclosures, which makes sense. But to what extent did you also go and look at particular standards and contents of standards? Because you say you test concepts, but within specific standards, there can be things that are in there that are not in the framework. So I'm just wondering how you brought those pieces together.
Yep, sure. We have explained that. So I think what our process was, even though we said test the concepts, I think, we did kind of two flows. We first took what is existing in Topic 820, what the existing requirements are, and we measured that up against the concepts. So we went line by line of the disclosures and saw, what is there something indicated in the framework for that why this disclosure should be required. So in some cases, maybe the board could decide, this isn't required or isn't supported by the concepts, but we think it's really important information. It's cost beneficial, so we're going to retain that. So that's kind of the one workflow we went through. And by that, maybe some were removed, some were modified, such as the future-oriented information. And then the other workflow is that we also took kind of a clean sheet of paper, took the concepts and all the decision questions that are within the concepts, and we said, what kind of disclosure is required by this, and we mapped it up to the existing requirements, and we kind of saw where there were holes in the requirements. So in some cases, the gains and losses, level 3 was required, but level 1 and 2 wasn't, and we thought that the concepts really indicated, it doesn't discriminate against level, so we thought if this information is important for level 3, maybe it's important for level one and two, which is why it was in the proposal. So kind of we did both ways. So you're right. We did it, looked at the concepts, but we also looked at the standards, and that was across all of the topical reviews.
Christine?
Oh, sorry.
No, okay, Xiangwu.
Thank you. On your slide 5, there are 4 items that you are going to remove. The third item is evaluation process for level 3 fair value measure. So you are going to remove that kind of a disclosure on this evaluation process. However, interestingly enough, on our paper, slide 13, this evaluation process is one of most useful information to our stakeholders. So why do you think enough? You need to remove this kind of a disclosure on this process.
Yep. So we went through this disclosure. This was one that we didn't think was appropriate for notes. So this disclosure, it's really the internal control policies about evaluation committee that somebody might have, an entity might have. So I think although we found, you know, this is the useful information, I think it would be useful for any line item on the balance sheet to know what are the internal control policies and how, you know, what is the review process. So I think the board decided that it wasn't appropriate for notes, and we don't have this disclosure again across any other line items.
So this is kind of a item that comes from simplification of disclosures.
No. Yeah, that it wasn't indicated by the concepts. Although it might be useful information, I think it would be useful for any line item to know the valuation and internal control policies.
Yeah, I would just say maybe the word valuation processes isn't as descriptive as you might think. Well, there was a specific disclosure in there that we called valuation processes that was being interpreted as the internal controls around how the companies were coming up with their fair value approaches. And it was something that we put in right at the beginning of 157 when 157 was new. And now we thought it really wasn't appropriate for disclosure. It doesn't mean that companies don't have to disclose their methodologies. They do. And how they come up with their significant assumptions and estimates. But specifically around internal controls, why here and not everywhere else? So I don't know that we were saying the same thing. We might be talking past each other with those words.
Right. That's my fear, was what we call process may be something different than what you call process.
And we weren't disputing that it could be useful. It could be useful to know management's internal controls over all of assets and liabilities. But we set out a scope of what we thought should be in the notes, and we felt like we should really follow that. We shouldn't say, well, in this case, we're going to add to and have internal control reporting in the footnotes. If we do it here, why not everywhere else? What was so special about here? But again, we weren't, I don't think, disputing its usefulness, at least to some.
Any other questions or observations?
Yeah, again, this point Hal had brought up earlier around the other place that where we had internal debate and struggled was with level 1, level 2 roll forwards. And that might not have been specifically come out in our slide deck, but that was, again, the place where we had this discussion about, well, gee, in the financial services industry, it's probably pretty darn important to understand all the movements in and around level 1s and level 2s as well as level 3. But, should we force the disclosure or should we require the disclosure for every company in the hopes that non-financial companies would be able to use materiality to not include it and only financial services companies would end up including it? And the board ended up deciding not to do that. So we actually here considered industry-specific disclosures and putting it in. We have a codification topic that just deals with, like, depository institutions and insurance. We could have done something like that and tried to scope it. And we actually had, a full board meeting just dealing with that issue, and it wasn't a slam-dunk decision about what to do about that, because to Hal's point about, is it broadly relevant to every kind of company, or is it really just supremely relevant but only to a subset of companies and investors?
And I'll just point out, to show that the flaw with going an industry approach, there was discussion in the bond markets this week about 3 non-financial services companies withdrawing from bond market because of tax law changes and things, and that's moving the market. These are non-financial entities. They're so big in the bond market, they're moving it. And by doing this approach, we basically said, you don't have to do that disclosure because you're not a financial services company.
Industry specific.
It's one of the problems that we talked about earlier with having industry-specific guidance.
Mary?
I'm going to clue up Peter to listen hard and see if this needs any correction. But my going back to the point Christine was making about user interest in unrealized gains losses being general rather than specific, I think that we heard something slightly different. And I think part of it was going back to how we especially focused the request for information is we pushed really hard to get information about what users found useful and why and how they used it. And my personal kind of summary of that is they found information about level three particularly useful because they wanted all different insights into how level three was affecting the financial statements, both the balance sheet and the income statement. And so things like amount of unrealized or things like changes in as well as magnitude were all very important to them. And basically what they're saying is we look at the financial statements if, first of all, if items measured at fair value are relatively small quantum, we don't pay much attention. If it's large, then the next thing I want to know is how much is level three. Okay. And if it's significant, then I want to dig deeper. So I don't think we heard as much about level one versus level two. Maybe some questions about are we really convinced everybody's drawing level two versus level three in the same place? But the going into the request for information, the signals had been, especially from preparers, this information is so aggregated that we don't see how disclosures by level can be useful. And we certainly got some very, to me, kind of confirmatory feedback about it's useful not because we analyze, we disaggregate to make estimates of the future on this basis, but we want to understand how big a piece this is and how it affects the financial statements. So I think our feedback differed a bit in terms of it wasn't just overall what's the impact of unrealized, but it was really different ways of getting insights, particularly to level three, and there were some there's some additional feedback of if there's a large amount in level two, then yes, we also would be interested in that, but it's critical for level three. Is Peter that?
Yeah, that's consistent with what I remember as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks, team.